toxicology, and as many of you know, this is a special lecture that we're going to have today. This is the annual Socrates Award Lecture, and the Socrates Award Lecture, as you well know at this point in the course, comes to us via student vote. And this is when we ask students to kind of reflect on the past year, especially in the media, and what they know about toxicology, and to come forward with a nomination of a poison of the year. And what helps us do is to kind of come and find out what's happening out there in the media and in science in terms of new developments in toxicology. What's the problem? What's the word here? What's talking about in terms of the public arena? Well, what we've done is narrowed that down to several candidates, and actually this year students voted for the Socrates Award for toxic mold. This is has been in the media quite a bit in the past year, as many of you have observed, and especially in certain parts of the United States, the Southwest and Southeast, where they have mold-producing climate conditions. This has actually substantially had a very large economic impact in terms of housing and certifying houses as mold-free, or actually having to destroy houses that are contaminated by mold. So the issue for students in environmental toxicology is, what's all this about? What's all this stuff about toxic mold? Is this a traditional sort of hyped-up situation where it really isn't a big deal, or is there some scientific underpinning to this issue as it has developed in the media? With that, we actually sought out and found an expert-level lecturer for us today in environmental toxicology. That lecturer is Professor Roger Coulomb. And Roger comes to us from Utah State University. We're very fortunate to have him. He actually got his undergraduate and master's degree here at the University of Idaho in 1977. He went on, actually, so just like yourselves here as upper division undergraduates and graduate students, Roger at one point in time sat in these very same chairs. He has since gone on and gotten a PhD in food science and toxicology from Oregon State University and did some postdoctoral work at the University of California, Davis. He is now a professor at Utah State University and actually program director for the graduate toxicology program at Utah State University. He is actually an internationally acclaimed scientist in the area of the biochemical actions of all the mold toxins that we are exposed to, not only in airborne fashion, but also, more importantly, dietary fashion. Some of those mold toxins, as you may know, are carcinogens. And what Roger is going to do for us today is talk about some of the backgrounds to give you, a good shot in the arm on the issue of toxic mold from a scientific standpoint, and maybe put it in context in terms of what we are witnessing in the public media. So with that, I'll hand over the class and the lecture to Roger. Roger, thank you very much for joining
us
today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You bet.
All right. Well, it's a real honor to come here, and I thank my host for gracious hospitality, but it really is good to be here. I took a statistics class in this room. Actually, the chairs were probably much less comfortable than they were than they are now, but I left here in 1979 and went on to more graduate school, but I enjoyed my time here at University of Idaho, and I think I got a pretty good education. So, and as Greg mentioned, I direct the graduate program in toxicology at Utah State University. I don't know if any of you have been to Logan, but we're between two wilderness areas, between two mountain ranges, so 10,000 foot peaks. We're half an hour from a ski resort. Bit of an advertisement, if you're looking for a PhD in toxicology, master's in toxicology, we're the first interdepartmental graduate program in toxicology in the country. We've been going since 1962, so a lot of the good things that have happened in the program preceded me, but we also have a pretty good program, so give me a call anytime. If it's okay, I can mention that. But anyway, as Greg mentioned, I've been at Utah State since 1984 and have been continuing on my work in toxic mold, which I began over here in the Life Science Building in the basement, working with Dick Heimsch. And so I kept on with that in my graduate work, postdoctoral work, sort of entered more into the molecular realm of what these things do to tumor suppressor genes, things like that. But as Greg mentioned, you know, toxic mold, and this is to my delight, because we've known this, people like me have known this for quite some time, toxic mold is important. And we're now starting to see lots of media attention finally being directed towards some of the biological effects of toxic mold. So I think your choice of this topic is very timely. So anyway, what we're talking about here, you all know what mold is. Just go maybe look at the grout in your shower. I was just noticing in the hotel room there was a little bit of mold growth. Molds can grow just about anywhere. As the temperature increases, the moisture level increases, you'll start seeing more and more of this stuff grow around the area. But for most of the compounds, most of the toxicities that I'll be talking about, what I really mean are filamentous fungi that will grow on just about anything. These organisms here, and I've got, this is an Aspergillus slide here, just stained with methylene blue. You see the spores. Most of the toxins that we'll be talking about tend to become concentrated in these spores, but these molds have an unknown reproductive state, so they're called fungi imperfecti, most of them are. But these are basically in the same kingdom as mushrooms, lots of other things that you're pretty familiar with, but toxic molds can do a variety of things, and that's what I'm here to talk about this morning. Now, in terms of toxic molds, there's been a lot of hype in the last 5 or 6 years. In fact, many of you know this guy. He was the sideman to Johnny Carson, and probably preceded most of you, but Ed McMahon. And he's doing other things now, and he's involved in sweepstakes and things like that. But he contends that molds killed his dog, that his dog was poisoned by toxic molds. And in fact, other people that you probably are aware of are getting into the fray. Aaron Brockovich is now on a crusade against toxic mold. So lots and lots of, I guess, I don't know, high level, but mid-level celebrities are getting involved in this. But you know, what about all this hype? And there have been, in fact, when Greg was talking, I excused myself to grab this. I didn't mean to walk off the rostrum, but this was just in my local paper November 28th. So it was Thanksgiving morning. This is, I don't know if you can see this here, but it's an article. It says, mold in school causes health and money problems. This is in Tennessee. This is just in, you know, just so you know, I'm not making this up. This is just in my hometown paper, Thanksgiving Day. And I won't read the article to you, but the whole gist of it is that schools are being shut down because of mold growth. Tennessee, of course, is a very warm and moist environment most of the year, and so a perfect environment for growth of these things. Likewise, Time Magazine, July 2nd, 2001, had a cover story about toxic mold. TV programs, lots of newspaper articles. So if you go into Google search and type in toxic mold, these are the kind of things that you'll start seeing. So more and more media attention. Okay, what is it that is causing all this ruckus? Lots of high profile cases down in Texas. Major insurance companies are no longer underwriting homeowners insurance because of some of the claims, the health claims of toxic molds. Okay, when we talk about what they do to people and animals, and I'll focus primarily on human health risks, but there are many veterinary issues that I get involved in as well. But molds can be allergenic, in other words, cause an allergic response. This is just a sensitization to mold or mold products. One of the molds I'll talk about today works by this mechanism. The other thing is a direct infection of the fungus itself. In other words, you breathe in the spores. The spores sporulate, and then you start getting a mold bloom inside your lungs. There's a good example of this that I'll discuss this morning. Before I go on, if you have any questions, please just raise your hand, and I'll stop. We've got plenty of time, and we can take a leisurely pace going through the slides. But if there's any word I say, if any term that is not clear to you, please feel free to raise your hand. Direct infection of fungi, that's called a mycosis. Irritation, this is a mechanical effect of the spores or the mycelial debris. Now the mycelium is simply the filamentous part of the mold, not the fruiting body, but the stringy part. Also, volatile organics can cause irritation to lungs primarily, or skin. Perhaps the most important for us in toxicology is the mycotoxicosis. This is the problem that is produced when the molds secrete something that make us sick. Now, these toxins are called mycotoxins. It doesn't take a lot of imagination to figure out why that was named that way, but this is sort of my bread and butter. These are the things that I study in the laboratory that my graduate students study. A lot of these cause cancer, a lot of them short-term acute toxicity, and some are beneficial, as I'll mention. Okay, now there are many toxic molds, but just in the interest of brevity and trying to hit some high spots in terms of also some contemporary issues that I mentioned, I'll just talk about five molds today. And if one of you came this morning thinking, well, I wanted to find out about penicillium, well, I'm sorry, we're not going to talk about that. But there are a lot of issues with penicillium, which is another genus of fungus, that are important. And I don't mean to ignore those things, but I just wanted to hit a few high points, and in fact, some of the ones that I'm pretty familiar with, like the last one here, Aspergillus. But I have here a table, and I'll refer back to this just for mileposts to give you an idea of where we are in this morning's lecture. But I'll be talking about Stachybotrys, Coccidioides, Claviceps, Fusarium, and Aspergillus. With the exception of Coccidioides, these all produce mycotoxins, and that's the primary biological effect of these molds. This Coccidioides is primarily a mycosis. In other words, you breathe in the spores or the filaments, and the mold starts growing. And I'll show you some pictures of some of the clinical effects of that. But anyway, we'll be taking each one of these sort of bit by bit, and then again, refer back to this table as I go on to the next species. All right, what about these mycotoxins? These are primarily low molecular weight compounds. They're not required for growth, and most people really don't, well, it's really not understood why a mold will produce these compounds. These are called secondary metabolites, so they're not primary metabolites like lactic acid, NADPH, ADP, ATP. A fungus will produce these when they're at the resting state and they start sporulating. And so it's only a certain point of their life cycle that molds will start producing mycotoxins. When I say low molecular weight, going back to the last slide, primarily 200 to 500, mostly in the 300 range. Okay, these have precursors, either amino acids, polyketides, or terpenes. Most of them are either polyketide or amino acid. And so these are formed by condensation, sort of front to back condensation of these building blocks to produce a larger compound, again, about 300 to 500 molecular weight. Again, why they're produced, really no one knows. Some people believe that they're storage products for carbon source later on, or that molds have adapted to their environment and produce these to gain a competitive advantage against other biologic species, which makes a bit of sense because these mycotoxins are toxic. They kill cells, they kill other biologic organisms. Many of these are beneficial. You know about penicillin, discovered by Sir Arthur Fleming. This is just a toxin that is cytotoxic against bacteria. But we use a variety of antibiotics, not just to kill a bacterial infection that we might have, but also in tissue transplantation. We use cyclosporin, that's a mycotoxin, another example. Most, however, we, from our perspective as toxicologists, view them as adverse. So many of these cause toxic responses within minutes of ingestion. Lots of others, maybe in 10, 20 years down the track, they might cause cancer or some other long-term effect. Okay, let's talk about the first one, Stachybotrys, because this is the one that is in the news. This is the fungus that grows in, along with lots of others. This is a toxic fungus that grows in water-damaged homes. If there's a pipe leaking or the sprinkler system gets out of hand and leaks into the basement, begin seeing mold damage from Stachybotrys. The main species is Chartarum. That's also called Atra. There's a third species that is also reckoned to be all one species. In other words, you hear this mold described in three species names, but they're all probably the same fungus. There's really nothing distinguishing them. Hay and cellulose products. So any kind of cellulose product is the preferred substrate for these guys. Anytime you have something like moldy hay in certain environments, this mold will start blooming. But a lot of the interest we have in this country is from water-damaged buildings, primarily in warmer climates, but also in areas, as I'll show you, in the northeast United States. It's all over the world. We find it just about anywhere. This is a slide showing mold-damaged hay on the top with control hay on the bottom. So actually, you can get poisoned by this mold by simply handling contaminated substrates like this hay. Or, as I'll show you later on in a second, people have been actually poisoned by this by breathing in the spores from close association with contaminated commodities. Okay, this is what water-damaged mold looks like. This is an interior wall. I believe this was taken in Cleveland, showing this black bloom of the Stachybotrys. So you see this. Then you start questioning, well, this flu I had last week, is it due to this fungus? Well, more and more attorneys are getting into the fray, and in fact, some very high-level, high-profile cases have been awarded to clients who've sued schools, who've sued their homeowners insurance, previous owners that sold a house. Maybe they didn't know it had mold damage, but hire an attorney, and there you go. In some cases, what people have done is done the ultimate thing, just burned their house down, because it's very difficult to treat to remove affected building materials. So this is what happens in some extreme cases. And so you can imagine the awards have been pretty high. The damage awards have been pretty high to plaintiffs in some of these lawsuits. And as I mentioned, down in Texas, some large insurance companies no longer underwrite homeowners insurance, primarily because of these large awards. Generally, the first step that homeowners do if they're worried about this is to hire an inspector like this gentleman here. And a cottage industry has sprung up in many parts of the country to do mold inspections. One of the easy ways to determine if you've got some of these toxic molds present in your home is to do a scotch tape test. You take a piece of scotch tape, press it up against a damaged wall where this black fungal bloom is, and then take it back to your laboratory and look at the fungus and the spores. One thing you need to understand is that the presence of the mold itself does not mean the presence of the toxin. I should have mentioned earlier that even a mycotoxin-producing strain, if the strain is present, that doesn't necessarily mean the toxin is present. So in every case, it's always, as toxicologists, you need to keep this in mind, that if a mold is present, that doesn't necessarily mean the toxin is present. The toxin, in most cases, is what does the biologic damage.
I have a question.
Yes.
If you have the mold without the toxin, can that mold later on develop into a toxin-producing mold?
Possibly, given the right conditions. That's a good point, but it's important if in case studies, for example, to look to see what kinds of analyses were done. So again, just the mere presence of the mold isn't sufficient, at least as scientists. Now, in a court of law, you need to be 51% sure to convince a judge and jury that that something caused disease. As scientists, we need about 90 to 95% surety to understand cause and effect here. Okay, what about this mold we've been talking about? The toxicosis, described in animals, it causes irritation in the upper respiratory tract, shock, dermal necrosis, a decline in certain populations of white blood cells, pulmonary effects, hemorrhaging from the lungs, and in severe cases, death. Okay, we know of a number of epidemics. A lot of them were first described in Russia in the 19th century of people actually dying, large numbers of people dying. And generally with most mycotoxicoses, when there are deaths or an epidemic of some medical problem with a toxin, generally what you need is a product like corn or rye or barley that's locally produced and locally consumed. So you have a cell of people that grow all their own food and consume all their own food. Commerce tends to dilute the toxin. So if you have a barley field and it gets contaminated with Stachybotrys, if you trade and sell and you buy your rye from a broker, if you're a baker, for example, the product probably came from a variety of locations. And so that tends to protect people from some of these mycotoxicoses. But early on, some of these effects in animals and people were noticed in Russia. And generally when agricultural practices were not the best, in other words, if a lot of hay were allowed to overwinter or become really wet, just kept in the field and then harvested in the spring, or wheat or barley, the overwintering with the moisture that is ensues is just perfect for certain kinds of molds. And in fact, one of the epidemics, the disease was called alimentary toxic aleukia because of the effect on white blood cells of these toxins. Okay, in 1931, there was another epidemic, a smaller number of people that inhaled mold from hay and contaminated bedding. They were using hay to sleep on. They're stuffing mattresses with hay or just sleeping directly on hay, and people were becoming infected. And in fact, a lot of the symptoms were people noticed were identical to the ones that their livestock were experiencing. In today's world, we see occasional occupational cases, places like cottonseed plants, textile mills, any place where goods that are cellulose-based are processed or stored. Okay, what are the toxins that are produced? These are a class of compounds called trichothecans, and there are several classes, but trichothecans are heterocyclic compounds with an epoxide. And I apologize for my, I used to be a beta tester for this software, and one of the, I filed a report about a couple of years ago on one of the problems importing this into PowerPoint, and I just noticed when, anyway, you see these boxes here. Those white boxes aren't supposed to be there, but anyway, you get the idea. These are large compounds, about 280 molecular weight, with an epoxide. These are very toxic. These are the agents that actually do the cause of toxicity. These are some various classes here. You'll have access to these slides to look at them later on. I'm not going to spend too much time, but these are well known to cause a variety of toxic responses. Other fungi, especially Fusarium, also produce these compounds as well. Okay, so in people, people can be exposed by inhaling the spores or through dermal exposure, but it's actually the toxin that does the damage. So dermatitis, this is an inflammation of the skin, inflammation of mucous membranes, upper respiratory symptoms, fever, decline in certain populations of white blood cells, headache, fatigue, and then recovery. Now, one of the most recent issues surrounding this mold is whether it causes a specific effect in infants. And I'll mention a case study that is really well known in people in this field, and that's infantile pulmonary hemorrhage, or the other term I should have put on my slides here is idiopathic pulmonary hemosiderosis. Hemosiderosis you probably have heard in this class, but it's the accumulation of iron in macrophages in the lung, and it's the same kind of clinically, at least grossly clinically, it causes a hemorrhage from the lungs. So infantile pulmonary hemorrhage. Case study here I can just mention, it's pretty well known, from Cleveland in 1994, where they discovered a cluster of cases in one neighborhood in Cleveland. 10 infants were affected, one expired, and all of these cases were associated, had these things in common. Major household water damage 6 months prior to illness, increased levels of measurable fungus in the home. And then once these samples were taken back to the lab, some of these were toxin producing. So the CDC did a report, a variety of reports here. I've got the references here. So these are CDC people, as well as people working with in collaboration with CDC personnel, published a variety of papers indicating that this might actually be a cause of this one death and then nine others that were pretty seriously affected. This case in Cleveland formed the impetus for more and more lawsuits in other parts of the country, and so people took this as being the touchstone for other cases. And so when people heard this in the news, went downstairs and saw a black fungal bloom in their basement, they called their lawyer, and so more and more cases sprung up from this case study. Okay. Now, one thing I wanted to mention is it's always good to be able to look at a variety of studies as scientists and be critical, to critically evaluate studies to see whether they're designed properly, whether they ask the right questions, and whether they came to the correct conclusions. And so the Centers for Disease Control hired a variety of scientists from CDC as well as some outside experts. He didn't hire me, so I'm a little skeptical of that last one, but they actually looked at all the studies that were published and found a few inconsistencies. And then they concluded later on, in fact, at the top of the slide, they found no association with Stachybotrys contamination and IPH, infantile pulmonary hemorrhage. Some of the inconsistencies were that samples from the sick homes, in other words, from the sick children, were analyzed a lot more rigorously. Twice the number of air samples were taken, and then when investigators came or analyzed the mold from homes from sick infants, they used more rigorous sampling methods, like took up carpets and shook them out to disturb up the mold, and they didn't use these same methods in the control homes, so homes that did not have sick children but had mold growth. Secondly, they did not have standard methods for a variety of very critical experimental procedures, such as defining what water damage meant. They had no specific criteria for what water damage meant, just a little bit, a lot, standing water, so on and so forth. They had no standard methods for the inspection and data collection. As scientists, we know that data collection is important, needs to be standardized if you're trying to make an association between cause and effect. And what the definition of infantile pulmonary hemorrhage is. They just used a generic definition that any sort of bleeding from the pulmonary tract classified or qualified as IPH. And we know that's not true. There are a variety of other diseases that will cause this. And so, again, the Centers for Disease Control, not a retraction, but a paper published in 2000, basically said that data is insufficient at this point. And I believe that there might be something there, but until we have real good cause and effect data from studies that are well analyzed, we won't know. Again, the truth will be determined sometime, but these papers that I cited earlier don't seem to be nailing it down. Okay, are there any questions? If not, we can move on to the next one. But coccidioides is another, yes?
What are the methods they use for analyzing these toxins? Some of the methods?
Some of the analytical methods? Primarily HPLC. These compounds can be very easily determined by liquid chromatography. They're fluorescent. You saw the double bonds on them. Very easy to do.
So what would be the difference if you make, if you have rigorous samples and the control samples? You are speaking about that, like they were in the affected houses. The samples were taken more rigorously. So
yes.
What difference would have been made if it was less rigorous?
Okay, another parameter that the investigators used was the number of colony-forming units in their sample. So in other words, the number of spores that they picked up. And I believe one of the studies that showed mycotoxin production was only from the homes from sick children. I've read the paper a few times, but I don't seem to remember that control homes were analyzed for mycotoxins.
Yeah, but I think through HPLC we can detect whatever the toxins levels. With the least level also we can detect it. So I don't think that there should be any difference if the measurements were taken rigorously or not. If it was like the toxins were responsible, they have to just identify it. They could have identified it.
Okay, but if you don't measure toxins in the control population, in this case a group of homes, then the association is difficult to make.
Okay, what about
this next fungus? Coccidioides is an interesting fungus, and it primarily causes effects through a mycosis. In other words, an actual fungal bloom inside a person's respiratory tract. So a very interesting type of mold. We've known about its effects since the late 1800s. Here's a picture, micrograph of Coccidioides. The main species is Immitis. Again, this is where we have an inhalation of the spores or the actual filaments that break off in the wind, and growth of the fungus in a person's respiratory tract. Most of these cases are asymptomatic. Most are self-resolving within a few weeks. But it causes sort of nondescript symptoms, and a lot of poisons will do this. Some heavy metals will do this, but just a generalized feeling of malaise, aches and pains and fever. Sometimes you might think, well, my roommate had the flu last week. That's got to be what this is. Well, Coccidioides causes the same type of nondescript chronic fatigue type symptoms. This is known as valley fever. Greg and I both lived in the Central Valley of California at UC Davis, which is right about here. And at least I knew well, I was introduced to valley fever when I moved down to Davis. I've heard about this. There were articles in the newspaper. I didn't pay much attention. But this is endemic in these areas. In fact, the black area on this map here that you can see is where Coccidioides disease, the mycosis, is endemic. So the Central Valley of California, hence the San Joaquin Valley fever, but also the general southwest region of the United States. Cases in Texas, New Mexico, Arizona. The CDC has termed this in the last few years an emerging disease. Even though we've known about this since the late 1800s, it's an emerging disease because of the demographics, a huge demographic shift of a population base from northeastern United States, southern United States, into the southwestern United States. Arizona, Nevada and Utah have been some of the fastest growing states in the last 10, 15 years. So more and more cases are being reported. So again, even though this is an old disease, it's termed an emerging disease because more and more cases are being reported. It's also in the list of AIDS-defining diseases. So a person who is immunocompromised, such as an AIDS patient, is much more susceptible to getting this disease because of a decreased immune response. Again, most of us are fairly resistant, have maybe nondescript symptoms if there's an infection that's self-resolving. But in the case of a person with other predisposing diseases, it can be much more serious. I mentioned, you can actually see this in an x-ray, for example, this diffuse, opaque region showing the filaments in this x-ray. You can, if you take a close look at that, see the You can see the filamentous growth. But some of the symptoms, again, acute bronchitis, fever, cough, chills, sore throat, all of us get these once or twice a year. We don't normally think of mold growth as being the culprit. It's generally some kind of influenza that's going around or some upper respiratory disease. It can move into pneumonia, leukocytosis, so proliferation of certain white blood cells. It can progress into more serious disease states, low-grade fever, again, getting worse and worse as we move down, anorexia, weight loss, skin ulcerations and abscesses. Here's a photograph of some of these pinpoint type ulcerations. And there are about four or five kinds that have been described in the literature. Progressive cyanosis. In serious cases, kidney and hepatic involvement. Okay, are there any questions about coccidioides? Looks like there, yeah.
Well, I guess in the cases of both of these or all these molds, if you're exposed and you develop symptoms and then exposure stops, does the immune system, is the immune system capable usually of getting rid of these, you know, molds in your body?
Yeah, that's a good point, but if you live in the Central Valley of California or in Southern Arizona, unless you move to Hawaii for 3 weeks, how are you going to stop symptoms? I mean, there's certain things you can do to avoid this, but this comes from, whereas the first fungus comes more from indoor environments, this is more of an outdoor environment. This is mold that just grows in the environment outside and gets whipped up by winds, and people just breathe it in. Just you can go out jogging, doing something healthy, but actually inoculate yourself.
And if there's a level of exposure will cause this sometimes severe symptoms.
Well, once the mold gets a foothold, but in most cases it's self-resolving, just very nondescript symptoms, and that's a picture of your immune response overcoming the fungal growth.
And in the first case, if you moved away from the water-damaged home, are you likely to get overall symptoms?
Yeah. Well, if that's the culprit, then yes, that would be something that would help, certainly. And that's why people have burnt down their homes in some severe cases. Yeah, so it's one of the principles of toxicology. The dose makes a poison. If you reduce the dose, the effect of the poison. These compounds, well, the trichothecans from Stachybotrys, they are cumulative, but when a person is moved away from an infectious environment, the toxic effect will decline slowly over time. And that's the case with all of these, the compounds that are produced by all these fungi. If the dose is reduced, the disease response will be reduced or eliminated. Oops, I touched the space bar here. Okay, claviceps. I put this in here because it's very interesting toxicologically. I mentioned this to my students. We have a bit of a problem agriculturally with this mold. It's primarily a mycotoxicosis. In other words, a toxin that claviceps produces is the culprit in the disease state. And it's a very interesting compound. This is why I'll mention it here. But this has been known since 13th, 14th century. The disease caused by claviceps, primarily purpurea. This grows in wet and overwintered grains. Again, this overwintering problem that is more of an issue where agriculture is subsistence, is farming, primarily rye, barley, and wheat. Here is what some wheat sheaves look like with a fungal bloom. Or the claviceps will grow, and then in the resting state, ball up into what's called an ergot, and these are actually very, very hard. You bite down one of these and it might break a filling, break a tooth. And we find these in our laboratory occasionally. A farmer will send us some samples with ergots in them. Primarily upper tier of states, the Dakotas, Montana, Utah, and some of the wheat grown in our state. I'm sure Idaho has occasional problems with this. Again, it's been a problem throughout antiquity almost. when you have a locally grown and locally consumed product. I remember as a undergraduate here reading about ergotism, and I went to the library here, which I see is expanded and much nicer than when I was here. But looking at an old Life magazine from 1946 of a, it was an article about a poisoning in France, right, post-World War II. Now, right after World War II, Europe was just struggling to get back on its feet. Agriculture was not as mechanized as it had been pre-war. And so there were certain sporadic episodes of what we call ergotism from the toxin that's produced by this fungus. The toxin produces gangrene. It's a vasoconstrictor. So what it does is it constricts the smooth muscle, the smooth muscle in certain parts of the body, and it prevents blood from circulating primarily to the limbs, the hands, and the feet. And so gangrene can set in. This is a very kind of a burning type of response. It causes a lot of kind of a painful gangrenous effect. In animals, it causes decrease, weight gains, milk production, and so on and so forth. You all know about this compound here, lysergic acid dimethylamide, diethylamide, LSD. This is synthesized in the laboratory. This is what this compound, or this mold, produces, claviceps. It's called ergotamine, and it's a close relative. So it's got this indole group, and pharmacologically, it acts very similarly to LSD. So this causes not only gangrene, but also hallucinations. And in fact, this article, as I recall, in Life magazine, they rescued a man, an elderly gentleman, that was poisoned with ergotamine. He was up in a bell tower, and he was going to dive off because he said he could fly. And some gendarmes had grabbed him and saved him from a certain death if he had done this. But this is very well known. And again, major epidemics, 12th, 13th, 14th century Europe, from ergotamine, that causes a variety of very interesting pharmacologic effects, very similar to that of a well-known hallucinogen, LSD. So as I mentioned, ergotamine is a vasoconstrictor. It causes hallucinations and gangrene. In fact, you might have heard of this incident, St. Anthony's Fire. This is what the disease was called in 12th and 13th century Europe. The fire just meaning the sensation of burning that occurs in patients or in people that are poisoned. And in fact, a Jesuit order, the Order of St. Anthony, was started to minister to the people that were affected by this. And this causes deaths as well. But so the disease itself is called St. Anthony's Fire. And so you might have heard of this. But this is ergotamine, a very interesting type of effect. Again, just so you know, I'm not making this up. This was from my local paper, actually the same day as this one on molds in schools. This is, I don't know if you get this in the local paper, this is a sort of write-in. It's like Ann Landers, but this guy deals more with Dr. Gott. This guy deals more with medical problems, so people write him. And the question had to do with the Salem witch trials. Some of you know about the Salem witch trials, which, very interesting case in human history. But make a long story short, a group of people were accused of being sorcerers or witches, executed in a variety of ways. But there were trials, court trials, and people were executed on trumped up charges, basically. But the idea here is that a number of people believe that this was an outcome of ergotism, that people were in a hallucinogenic frenzy and started accusing people of doing all sorts of things that they saw them doing, you know, turning a cat into a newt or levitating or doing all sorts of weird things. And as you can see here, I've actually outlined this and made a PDF file. Dr. Gott is explaining that there is a theory that the Salem witch trials was an outcome of ergotism. So sort of an interesting point in our history, but a well-known disease throughout antiquity, ergotism is. And we get occasional poisonings in animals, even in this country today. Okay, Fusarium is a large genus of molds that produce a whole lot of toxins. And this is more of a problem agriculturally, but we've had throughout history a variety of human cases as well, with hundreds and hundreds of deaths over time. Again, primarily a mycotoxicosis. There are a variety of toxins produced by fusarium that cause cancer, cause a variety of acute effects. The fusarium that I'll be talking about primarily are Sporotracheoides and Graminearum. These are veterinary and public health problems. The main commodity here is corn, but also they'll grow on wheat and barley. I'll talk about three major toxins from fusarium, the trichothecans. These are identical to the compounds that are produced by Stachybotrys, by the way. And so this disease I told you about, alimentary toxic aleuchia, also occurs when fusaria produce toxin and people consume the food that are poisoned. I mentioned another toxin, zearalenone. Interesting compound. I'll tell you that this is an estrogenic compound. Have you discussed estrogenic xenoestrogens in this class? Okay, these have a very high affinity for the estrogen receptor and cause estrogen-like effects in animals and people. Fumonisin is a recently discovered mycotoxin that is thought to be a human lung or liver carcinogen. Okay, what about the trichothecans? Here is the epoxide that I mentioned earlier. These are tetracyclic compounds, molecular weight between 180 to 300 roughly. T2 toxin, one of the most toxic ones. This is an immunotoxin, by the way. It causes immune effects. Nivalenol, deoxynivalenol. This is also called vomitoxin, named after the symptoms that these produce in laboratory animals and agricultural animals. Greg mentions that you've gone over some metabolic pathways. These are metabolized through either the hepatic microsomes or also intestinal microflora to detoxified metabolites. These are less toxic than the parent compound, T2. Some toxicity in animals and people, digestive disorders, hemorrhage. This is primarily of the peritoneal cavity, edema. So swelling with water of various organs, oral lesions, blood disorders. The last one here is one that many researchers that study trichothecans focus on, the immunotoxic effects of these compounds. The mechanism of action of T2 toxin is it binds to ribosomes, so the protein synthesizing mechanism in your cells, and it inhibits all phases of protein synthesis. Okay, zearalenone is another toxin that is always a problem given certain weather patterns, certain agricultural practices, but every year in places like Minnesota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Iowa, there are veterinary problems dealing with the fusarium secreting zearalenone. Here is zearalenone itself. It's often coincident with T2 toxin because it's produced by the same fungus. Again, in the same sorts of commodities, corn, wheat, barley, oats. High humidity and low temperatures are conditions that this mold really likes. And so autumn harvest of some of these compounds, if harvest has been delayed because of weather, then this is what will happen. I'll just go through these quickly, but some veterinary effects due to the fact that this compound interacts with the estrogen receptor, in fact, with very high affinity compared to a lot of other foreign estrogenic compounds. But it causes a feminization in sows, vulvovaginitis. In boars, it causes testicular atrophy and large nipples. It does the same kinds of things as other xenoestrogens like tetrahydrocannabinol, the active ingredient of marijuana. In other animals like cows, it causes a decline in conception rates. So very hormonal, estrogenic type of symptoms, very consistent with its estrogen receptor binding activity. Slightly less than that of estradiol, but equal to that of 17-beta estradiol. The pigs, if you take out the estrogen receptor from pigs, And you can actually do this in a laboratory. We don't do this, but a colleague of mine does this. You can actually test the receptor affinity from various species to the zearalenone. It turns out that swine, the receptors from swine have the greatest affinity for zearalenone than other animals, and swine are the most susceptible. Fumonisin, this was discovered in the early 80s, so it's a relative newcomer to the list of mycotoxins. Here is fumonisin at the bottom. Again, like zearalenone, it's often coincident with T2 because it's produced by the same mold. Again, late autumn harvest is a prime condition. These are just some symptoms. It produces a very debilitating and fatal toxicosis in horses. Equine leukoencephalomalacia, or ELEM. This is also called moldy corn toxicosis. What fumonisin does is it inhibits the production of important molecules in the central nervous system, and it causes sort of a liquefaction of the brain and the spinal cord. And so the animal starts stumbling around, slobbering, losing weight, bumping into fence posts. And this is the response from the severe cerebral edema from the toxicosis from fumonisin. In pigs, it causes a pulmonary edema. Again, same compound, but just a different animal. It causes a completely different effect. A South African group has been very active in actually discovering fumonisin, or discovering its mechanism of action. But it's thought to be a liver carcinogen. It's a very potent liver carcinogen in laboratory animals. It's thought maybe to be responsible for certain cases of liver cancer in Africa and elsewhere as well. I'll just go over this. This is a pathway showing the pathway of ceramide synthetase, or excuse me, sphingolipid biosynthesis, showing the two points at which fumonisin B1 causes its effect. And it's a specific inhibitor of the enzyme ceramide synthetase. So it decreases and eliminates synthesis of glycolipids that are important in the central nervous system. And so it inhibits CNS activity as well as the structural integrity of the brain and spinal cord. Excuse me. Okay, the last one I'll talk about is probably the mold that most is known about. This is my bread and butter. This is what I've been studying for 21 years. Aspergillus. This is a well-known mold because it produces cancer in laboratory animals, and it is is strongly suspected to be a human lung and liver carcinogen, primarily liver carcinogen. This has been known, the toxin itself, since the early 1960s. Aflatoxin is the toxin. It's named after the mold that produces it. It's a universal food contaminant. Just about any product containing corn or peanuts will contain some amounts of aflatoxin B1. There are many aflatoxins. This is the largest concern, aflatoxin B1. It's named B because it fluoresces blue under an ultraviolet light, and this is one way you can detect it if you're worried about some peanuts you have that look moldy. If you have an ultraviolet light, a black light, borrow it from your parents, maybe they had it over their Jimi Hendrix poster. You can shine that, plug it in and shine it on the peanuts, and if they glow sort of a blue, then that's strong indication that you've got some aflatoxin in your peanuts. So don't eat them, and don't feed them to your dog. Throw them out. All right, I mentioned it's an animal carcinogen. When I was at Oregon State, I was doing studies where we put in a tank of rainbow trout diet with roughly 5 parts per billion aflatoxin, and a high percentage of them would come down with a liver tumor in 6 to 8 weeks. So it's a very potent carcinogen, very natural. If you think things that are natural can't harm you, well, think again, because aflatoxin B1, along with all the other compounds we've been discussing this morning, are very toxic. This is probably of the greatest concern of all the ones I've mentioned so far. It is the only natural chemical that is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. The action level is set right now at 20 parts per billion. This was set, again, about 1966, I believe, mid-60s, and set primarily on the basis of the detection limits at the time. Now we can detect much less than one part per billion. So what the action level means is that the Food and Drug Administration can withdraw food from the market if it has aflatoxin greater than 20 parts per billion. This is a bit sobering when we learn that certain laboratory animals can get cancer at much less than 20 parts per billion. So some in the field believe that maybe this action level should be decreased. It's a very good case study for economic benefit versus potential medical risk. Okay, the IARC, it's a European Cancer Research Organization, classifies this officially as a human liver carcinogen. Aflatoxin B1 is a liver carcinogen probably by virtue of the fact that it binds to DNA, primarily at guanyl residues, at guanines. It also causes a specific mutation in the tumor suppressor gene P53. I won't talk too much about that. Occupationally, it is perhaps a lung cancer risk from people inhaling agricultural commodities that have aflatoxin in them. So corn, peanuts, primarily. So in a peanut meal plant, a peanut butter plant, a company producing corn chips, tortillas, those are all potential. One thing about aflatoxin B1 is that unlike T2 toxin, it requires metabolic activation. So your liver sort of conspires to make aflatoxin B1 worse. And this is what happens. Well, the main enzyme system is the cytochrome P450 system, which I'm sure you're familiar with. This is just a diagram showing sort of the flip-flop nature of how molecules are oxidized and reduced to produce reducing equivalents to take a substrate like aflatoxin B1 and add an oxygen to it. So it uses a heme-based protein, the cytochrome P450, that gets its reducing equivalents primarily from the pentose phosphate pathway by way of a P450 reductase. So what happens in your body, if at lunch today you have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich with 8 to 10 parts per billion aflatoxin B1, is this. So a whole bunch of metabolites from aflatoxin. Here's our parent compound. This is what's in peanut butter, and this is what your liver is doing. Some of these are much less toxic, but some are much more toxic, like this 8,9-epoxide here, which is the ultimate bad guy. This has a very short half-life of about half a second, but what this does is it finds out nucleophiles and has engages in, remember, in for organic chemistry, an SN1 reaction. It's a nucleophilic reaction with DNA and causes a mutation in your DNA. Detoxifying pathway is to produce a detoxified glutathione addict. So if you have enough of this very beneficial tripeptide glutathione, then you're protected, as well as the enzyme glutathione transferase, which I have abbreviated here as GST. Again, a bit of a busy slide, but it kind of shows you what happens biochemically in your liver after you ingest aflatoxin B1. This is what we do in the laboratory. We study how humans, how people metabolize aflatoxin B1, and it's primarily, we identify this in lung, by the way, a subpopulation, cytochrome P450-1A2. There's several hundred isoforms of P450, but it's primarily these two that do it, ultimately producing a clinically evident tumor. Okay, so what we're doing in the laboratory is trying to determine whether aflatoxin B1 is a lung cancer risk, and we're doing a variety of studies with organ donor tissue, also cultured lung cells in which we've transformed with clone DNA from various cytochrome P450s. But aflatoxin B1 remains a real significant public health concern, primarily in areas with very high aflatoxin, very high liver cancer, parts of Africa, China, parts of India have very high levels of aflatoxin, as well as high levels of liver cancer. And so it's thought that aflatoxin B1 is responsible for a high proportion of those cases. So I think that's my last slide. And I took this about 3 weeks ago. This is southern Utah. I've got another project down there, and I just so happened to take a few days off and do some hiking and mountain biking. But anyway, this is the state symbol of Utah, the Delicate Arch. So if you have any questions, we've got some time, please feel free. And thank you very much for your attention.
When I asked you earlier about exposure to the toxin, you said removal from exposure will pretty much cure your mm-hmm. symptoms. What about in the case of where the mold grows in your lungs? It seems like the lungs would provide a great environment. Do we have bacteria or antibiotics that kill the mold? Will the mold continue to grow, or does it have a sort of life like a virus?
Well, in the case of you're talking about coccidioides,
yeah.
Most of those resolve. So a person's immune system overcomes the infection, but there are antibiotics. Lung diseases are very difficult to treat. I could have mentioned aspergillosis, which is a mycosis of another strain of Aspergillus, Aspergillus fumigatus, and that is pretty serious as well. A lot of fungal infections are very difficult to treat. And a pulmonary infection, if it gets a foothold and becomes pretty serious, can go either way. It can be fatal. But given supportive treatment, hospitals will often just treat the symptoms and keep a person, on a respirator. But there are antibiotics, antifungal agents that have usefulness in various cases. But much more difficult to treat than, say, a bronchitis caused by bacteria, generally. Yes?
What's a normal person's risk from getting cancer or getting sick from any of these molds? I would think it's pretty slim. I mean, unless, your occupation, your job puts you in line to some of these things.
Well, it runs the gamut from, yeast infection, that's a fungus, essentially. And they use some of the same drugs for that, but for some of these dietary carcinogens like aflatoxin B1, what I tell my students is, liver cancer in this country is down the list of types of tumors that Americans get, but it's probably a good idea just to eat a varied diet. If you have a lot of one thing, you could be at high risk. It just, it really depends. What we're studying, I have another student that's studying components in the diet that can reverse the cancer process or prevent the toxic insult of aflatoxin B1, primarily by inhibiting the enzyme that activates it. And so a diet rich in, say, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts can actually protect a person if you're worried about aflatoxin. That question is very complex and it's very difficult to answer. If you do the right things, you're statistically protected, but not absolutely protected. One of the problems as a toxicologist, I have to couch a lot of what I say with qualifiers. I don't want you going home tonight and worrying about a little bit of moldy cheese. It might be a good idea to cut it out along with some of the healthy cheese around it. I wouldn't eat anything moldy if I knew, unless it's blue cheese that has a mold in it for a reason. I don't know if that answers your question, and I don't know if you want reassurance, but what I wanted to do is sort of open your eyes to some naturally occurring organisms that cause disease. Again, it depends on physical state, your general state of health, your location, where you live, the kinds of things you eat, your diet, where you get it. All those things factor in. So I'm probably not answering your question.
Yeah, I'm in the military, and where we have significant amounts of base housing.
Yep.
If I'm in a situation where somebody just read about toxic mold and found some mold in their base housing, what would be your recommended course of action at that point, both from a public education standpoint and a testing it to see if there is a real problem or not?
Right. Well, interesting you mention that, because I have a graduate from our program that I was on his committee. He joined the Navy after he got his bachelor, or a master's degree in toxicology. And he's been in Arizona, he's been in Guam. I just got an email from him 3 weeks ago asking these questions. So he asks those very same questions by email, and he's been doing this for 5 or 6 years. What he does is to do a scotch tape test, take it back, try to identify the mold, send off a sample of the substrate, so maybe some wall board that's got mold in it, off to a lab to see if there's toxin. He deals a lot with Stachybotrys. That's probably the number one mold he dealt with down at Yuma, Arizona, where he was stationed. So all those things. Decontamination can be done with a dilute solution of hypochlorite, so 5% Clorox in water. But again, one of the problems is that further wets the area. So try to keep, if there's a pipe that's leaking, fix it. Maybe move people out temporarily while remediation is done. But calling people that know about it as consultants. So the people in the Navy, I know, Army, that do this all the time. Anyone else?
In the case of a water-damaged home, if you thoroughly dry the area, are you pretty much preventing the growth of the mold or killing it?
It often requires either decontamination or removal. I remember living here, this is a bit more of a wet environment compared to where I live in Utah. We had about 18 inches of moisture in Logan. I don't know what it is here, maybe. Okay. But I remember having a pair of hiking boots, my beloved hiking boots, and I kept them in the corner of a closet, and I just, for 8 months, and they had this white bloom of mold on them, and I just tossed them. But I know that there are ways that you can treat a home with mold infestation. The picture I showed you of a burning house, that's the absolute last resort. But there are lots of things you can do.
Yeah, I don't know if you can answer this. I used to live in a rental house in the Midwest, and we had mold in the basement, like tons of it. And I can imagine telling my landlord that we went there to get the mold tested to see it was toxic. I mean, is there any sort of rights for people? I don't know if you're able to answer that question.
Well, American jurisprudence is catching up to that, but in terms of if taking a scientific approach, to do the things that I talked about is taking samples, finding out if there are toxins. But we really don't know now that these toxins from Stachybotrys, for example, cause human effects. We know they cause effects in animals, but we don't know whether, like some of the symptoms I showed you, for example, IPH, that syndrome, is caused by the toxin. We still don't know that yet. So even then, you won't be sure. But breathing mold in generally will cause certain types of low-grade diseases. So if there are problems, in this apartment was there was a storm drain next to it that was leaking down in the basement, a variety of things can happen. It just depends on whether your landlord or landlady wanted to fix it in the first place. But to tell them that this is making me sick, that's a bit of a stretch at this point.
Yeah, well, we used to joke every time we got sick, we blame it on the mold in the basement.
Possibly, yeah. But that's possibly the effect that we really don't know.
Is there any possibility that any of the toxins bioaccumulate? So if you eat pork, it's been affected by, a toxin from the mold. Is there the possibility that humans are exposed?
It doesn't bioaccumulate in the sense that PCB or DDT would in your fat. A lot of these are lipid soluble, but they're fairly rapidly metabolized. So the parent compound, you wouldn't normally find much in your body because it's metabolized. It's converted. And what happens is these binds to various molecules like DNA, and that's where you'll find the effect. But not in not in the classic sense of a synthetic high partition coefficient compound like PCB or DDT.
There's all kinds of media that are advertising out there for these mildew removers and stuff of that nature. Do you find any of those to be effective in controlling this at all, or are those more eyewash than
Well, the cheap solution is Clorox. If you've got mold in the shower or on the grout, there's spray products, but I really haven't evaluated those, but there are very inexpensive ways that do it just as good. Well, thank you. All good questions.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's honor our speaker with a round of applause.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Coulomb. I know, speaking for myself, I think we'll be all be cleaning our showers a little bit more often after your excellent presentation. And in appreciation for coming and visiting us here today in Principles of Environmental Toxicology, we have a plaque here, a Socrates Award Lecture, Toxic Mold, in thanks and appreciation to Professor Roger Coulomb. Roger, thank you very much.
Thank
for
you.
Your time.
It's very
and
nice.
Patience here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, once again, we've come through a Socrates lecture, and we do appreciate the students in the vigorous debates that I saw on email in terms of potential candidates for this year's lecture. All of the nominations, I think, were excellent nominations. Next time when we meet again, we'll talk about the future environmental outlook, how environmental toxicology interfaces with the future that you will all inherit as budding scientists and engineers. Until that time, thank you very much. Thank you.